The Jason Rance Show.
Jason Rance hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rance, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rance, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
The Centralia Police Department has come up with an interesting way to tackle crime, thanks to the limitations put on them by the Democrats in Olympia. We'll explain what that is. Another school is stepping forward and saying, enough is enough. You need to give us a plan on safety. What is the plan? We'll explain. Plus, New York City just unveiled vending machines for drug users. You get free crack pipes, Narcan. Oof, we're going to tell you why that will fail on this hour of the Jason Rance Show. So let's dive in.
The monologue.
So yesterday, a bunch of parents in Seattle, the Seattle Public School District, specifically over at Garfield High School, they got together, as they demanded to, with the school, with the district, with leaders, saying there's been an uptick of violence, 3 shootings within about a week of each other at our neighborhood, not on campus, near campus. And as best as I can tell, unless there's been a recent update, none of the instances of violence were directly connected to the school. But when you've got a whole bunch of crime happening right next door, yeah, you're going to be concerned, doubly so if you're a parent. So parents have gotten together and said, okay, what exactly is the plan? What exactly are you going to do to stop this from occurring in our schools? Because if it's happening next door, what if it happens on campus? Because there are a lot of parents who just, frankly, are being upfront about being scared. Here's a parent speaking with King 5.
Everybody's trying to do their best, but I don't know what's going on. People just want to shoot. What they get out of it, nothing. I have no idea, really.
Now, what I find curious here is that Seattle Public Schools, according to King 5, said that they're working with the police to basically increase safety in and around their schools. And you know, they say, and also we're looking at the district-wide issues, too. Fine. Now, all of a sudden, you're working with the police? You're the ones who helped contribute to this culture of lawlessness when they decided early on to kick school resource officers off campus. They did so at a time where there was a lot of public opinion locally turning against police officers, pretending that they are all racist murderers. And the school districts all across the state leaned into that messaging. Seattle Public Schools, probably the leader. When there was a school shooting, what was it, last October at Ingram High School in Seattle? You had students step up, student leaders step up and say, we don't want cops here, even after the shooting. Now, I don't think they represent the average student. I don't. I think that they represent, same way I talk often about the radical left, they represent a small group of folks on the left. The vast majority of people, I do think, are fine with cops on campus, especially in the form of school resource officers. But you can't have it both ways. This is a district that helped push cops away, literally and figuratively. And now they're acknowledging that maybe police should play a bigger role, but they don't want to take that position in a meaningful way. Yeah, we're working with the police. What does that mean? What does it mean you're working with the police? Because you have students like Sunshine who's demanding some answers.
Seems like they're doing a lot of things to keep, like, other people out. But, you know, like, a lot of shootings happen with, like, from students. And I don't think they're doing anything to, like, prevent that.
Now, I don't expect Sunshine to have a solution. But I do expect the superintendent, Brent Jones, to have some solutions. Or at least some ideas. They might not all be great. They may not all work. They may not even all be feasible. But what we don't hear is anything specific. Not really. Now, the specifics that we get, I don't know if it's going to be all that meaningful. For example, just before the weekend, he had said apparently that the district will see new campus signage happening in the fall that will help students and staff remember safety procedures. Okay, but the question is, how do we prevent the incident from occurring that one might turn to the signage for help during an emergency? That's the question. He said that they're currently replacing building locks to be activated from the inside of classrooms. That helps. That helps to a degree. Apparently, they're rolling out a new app where high school students can anonymously report safety concerns. I mean, I guess that can't hurt, but you can already do that, just not within the app. I think police have to play a bigger role, and I'm waiting for the school district to accept that and acknowledge it publicly and do so in a much bigger way. Now this.
The interview.
The Centralia Police Department has been in a position where they're needing to think a little bit outside the box to deal with legislation banning them from vehicular pursuits. They still have folks who know they can't be chased. So what exactly is being done? Well, the city is involved in a pilot program this month and next with flock safety cameras. Joining me on the line to discuss what this all means is Chief Stacy Denham. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for asking me.
So you've got 20 cameras set up around the city, presumably at intersections that are widely used. How does the program actually work?
Well, that's essentially how it works. So we have these cameras set up, and the program is it's a license plate reader, essentially, and with extra things that it can do. And that when cars come through, no matter where they're coming from, it reads the license plates very quickly, and it connects somehow with NCIC, and it can tell us that the car is stolen, or at least the license plate is stolen. It can also tell us if it's a person or a license plate that we're looking for like a silver alert or anything to do with any vehicles that we may be looking for or anything like that.
Who is in charge of the database in which it is using to figure out whether or not a license plate is being looked for?
There's two entities for that. One is Flock Safety, and the actual company itself that we lease these, because Flock Safety actually owns the cameras. And then we can actually enter in different vehicles that we may be looking for, both by a license plate or by a vehicle description. So if we don't have a license plate, but we know a crime has occurred, we can actually look for, say, if it's a white Subaru station wagon or SUV, we can actually search for white SUV Subarus and print up and get a look at all those and try to find out which ones are suspect.
Have you had any recent successes that you can give us just like a breakdown of how it works? Because in my mind, I think of this as a pretty cool tool that might not be applicable unless to the point that I saw in a story, unless the car is stopped.
Correct. And that's where the success story begins or ends, if you will, and that when the vehicle goes through the camera, and what we have it set up as when a license plate, the stolen license plate or a vehicle that we're looking for goes through the camera, it immediately sends my officers on duty a text message showing a picture of the car, the GPS location of it, and the license plate of the vehicle we're looking for, and tells if it's stolen or whatever it might be, whatever we're looking for the vehicle for. So given that, my officers respond to the area, and they start looking for the vehicles. Now, we're a little bit different here in Centralia because we have outlet stores. Mm-hmm. And we recognize that a lot of people go to those outlet stores to commit crimes.
Yeah.
So immediately we start, depending on what camera they go through, we start looking at the outlet stores, and that's where we've been having a lot of success with finding those cars at the outlet stores or in the surrounding area parked. In some cases, we find them obviously still being driven. Now, the ones that are parked, we will actually we have methods that we try to catch the driver of that stolen vehicle, and we use spike strips for that, and we spike the car just to make sure that it's not going to go very far. The other side is if we get behind it and is driving, that's where the state pursuit laws kick in. Mm-hmm. And then we have a lot of problems because we've come across a lot of them. They're still being driven. They just drop the gear and take off, and we have to watch them drive away.
Yeah. And I imagine it's going to be really easy for some lawmaker to take this completely out of context and say, well, see, they're doing it the right way in Centralia. It means we don't have to change any of our laws. But that is not what you're saying. You're saying this is a tool that is supplementing everything, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. That is definitely not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is this, is that we still daily have people who run from us for stolen cars, for a lot of different other reasons, and they just take off on us. Mm-hmm. And I expressed this before. Before the new law came into effect, my department got into approximately about five, you average four to six, I guess, pursuits a year. That being said, is pretty much all the pursuits we got into, vehicles were fleeing from us, and that's all that took off from us. Now we have vehicles that flee from us daily.
Yeah. Wow.
And we are just trying to find a way to help resolve some of those issues. And we are far from it. We still have people running all the time.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's happening all across the state. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about Centralia or Seattle, Tacoma or Bellingham. It's happening everywhere. My last question for you is, and part of the intention here is, I'm somewhat surprised that I haven't heard any concerns over the software from sort of the ACLU style crowd. And maybe that's informed by me living in Seattle. But I imagine that there's going to be some concern of, well, this is going to be abuse. This is Big Brother looking at us.
Absolutely. And I've heard the same concerns. Flock Safety has done an extraordinary job going through, and I think they've been through and worked with the ACLU. And that's the one thing and the concerns that people have is this Big Brother watching. But what it really is this is a license plate reader, which has been granted across the United States. It doesn't take video, and the technology, of course, as it changes daily, it seems like, is so good that it doesn't allow you to take pictures of people. So you get a picture of a vehicle, and it'll actually scrub out the picture or image of a person. So, and then all it does is basically take a thumbprint of a car and take a snapshot out of it, mm-hmm. which is right in line with everything else that we have as far as license plate readers go.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad people aren't pushing back, at least to the extent that I assume they might. But again, that comes from the Seattle perspective. We've been talking with the chief of Centralia PD, Stacy Denham. Chief, thank you so much for stopping by.
Hey, you bet. Thank you.
Now this.
The monologue.
It's another one of those stories where I can't say that I am shocked, nor am I really surprised, where New York City is unveiling public health vending machines that will include drug paraphernalia as well as the anti-overdose medication Narcan or Naloxone. It is right now just installed in one spot in Brooklyn, and according to Fox News, it carries Naloxone, which can reverse a opioid overdose, only opioid overdose. But on top of that, it includes, I like this, hygiene kits and safe sex kits for anyone with a New York City zip code. They say that on top of just those tools, they will end up having, and in this case will have, other specific items that help enable someone to continue to use. And so when they say like a harm reduction kit or something, what they're talking about in this case, they call it a safer smoking kit. It comes with a pipe. It comes with a mouthpiece. And this is all with the intent of helping someone who is smoking crack or crystal meth. The machine comes equipped with a safer sniffing kit, which includes, and I don't even understand where the sniffing part comes in. They say condoms, tampons, nicotine gum, and first aid packages. That according to the New York Post. Now, it looks like a vending machine that you would see anywhere. And it looks like a vending machine that includes soda or candy. So instead, it's basically a left-wing, hyper-partisan, safe reduction, harm reduction, whatever you want to call it, vending machine. This is going to be the new norm, I think. We already have some Narcan vending machines here in Washington State, in Western Washington. I know that they have them in Pierce County, I believe East King County. I wouldn't be surprised if they're all across Seattle in certain locations where homeless people and addicts go for resources. This is only postponing the inevitable death of every single addict. That's all that this does. You can talk about how it's safer to smoke crystal meth with one of their pipes, and technically it is quote-unquote safer, but it doesn't mean it is safe. And as we see more and more and more people who are dying of overdoses in New York, at least 1,370 confirmed fatal overdoses so far this year, or through at least June 1st, we're just enabling these people to continue their behavior that will ultimately kill them, because harm reduction does not get someone into treatment. We're told that it does. They don't actually tell us the success stories. They don't tell us the success stats. They just tell us that it is true. Simply telling us that it is true does not mean it is true. We know, as a matter of fact, as we have embraced harm reduction policies, we've seen a rise in overdose deaths. I think those two are connected.
The interview.
Well, there was some drama on the House floor today where a number of Republicans pushed back at House leadership as they were moving forward with a series of votes. Joining me on the line to help explain exactly what happened and why is our friend Congressman Ralph Norman, Republican from South Carolina. Welcome back to the show.
Well, glad to be with you.
So what happened exactly?
Well, there's been a lack of confidence since the vote on the debt ceiling. We had a package that was common sense in that it took out the 87,000 IRS agents. It took out the funding for students that want to go to college that charge the taxpayers with that. We had the RAINS Act in, which anything over $100 million had to be voted on. It couldn't be unanimous consent. We had a cap on what could be raised by this administration, that would the debt limit that would come due in March of next year. That's just some of the good things that we had in our bill that would give us economic security, mm-hmm. because it's national security. And a lot of us are just tired of saying, well, we'll do it tomorrow, or we will, we can't do this because of the Senate. Well, tomorrow is now. We can't back up. And what we agreed to, and I voted for the original bill, we had 218 votes versus what McCarthy took out were two different things. Everything we had agreed to was taken out. And I'll just give an example because it played out on the House floor today, the RAINS Act, which, as I mentioned, if Congress spent $100 million, you had to vote on it. Imagine it keeping it secret, which has been done for a long time. Well, that was stripped out, and PAYGO was put in, which could be McCarthy sold it as it was going to save all the trillion some odd dollars. And the only thing he left out was OMB could overrule it. So it was just in words. It didn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. So it came back up today, and the leadership was really pushing it. And we just said no. And to vote against the rule, and all that means to your listeners is when you vote against a rule, you stop it from coming to the floor for a vote. It's a no-no in Congress, but a group of us got together. A lot of us were members of the 20 that withheld our vote of McCarthy, mm-hmm. and we took it down. So,
well, was some of this also deflects just some of the power that this group of lawmakers have? Obviously, you're not excited about how the debt ceiling went, and just for Speaker McCarthy to become Speaker McCarthy, there was also a lot of negotiations back and forth. Was this a reminder of the power that you guys hold right now?
Well, what I believe and what I told him at caucus today is there's some confidence that has been lost in his leadership. And we just said, like on the debt bill, if you're going to just totally change what we had confidence that you're going to fight for, tell us. And the next step is appropriations bills. And I have no confidence that he's going to follow through on it. So, yes, in a way, this vote, we exercised our vote, and he's got the Republicans have a 3-vote majority. But we have meetings all the time. And there's been no meeting on this. It just was taken for granted we would support it. But we're supporting the very thing that he took out, allowed Biden to do away with in the original package that was sent over. So, yes, in a way it was. But, we're just done. We're not going to just lay down and let leadership run over us to get what they want. The other big thing that will come out is – there was a bill that Andrew Clyde had on banning certain guns.
And
they used that. Yeah, they used that. He was threatened that if he voted against the rule or for the debt bill, that they were going to not bring up his bill. And we brought that up this afternoon. Andrew was in the middle of it. And we just said that's no way to do it. To threaten us with withholding good bills, no. That's hurting our constituents. It's not the way you do business.
Was anything resolved today?
No. Well, what they promised, they're going to put the bill back up. There's a motion to recommit. We'll be voting on probably in a few minutes. But the trust factor's got to be built, and it's up to them to rebuild it. Everybody, I mean, more Democrats voted for the debt ceiling bill than Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a measure that we could use, and we're going to do more of it. If he's going to play this way, then we'll do this. We will, until we get some economic sanity back in government, and until we stop the spending spree that this country's been on, we're going to use every tool we have, and we really don't care the consequences of what leadership thinks or doesn't think.
There you go. We've been talking with Congressman Ralph Norman from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Thank you so much for stopping by, as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rantz.
And the rise of soft-on-crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rantz, is on that.
And you keep on bringing these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
As we reported to you yesterday, Caleb Heimlich is stepping down as chair of the Washington State Republican Party. He has not had a tough job. In fact, it's a valid question as what kind of person would want this job in deeply blue Washington State? How do we get more Republican victories? Joining me on the line is someone who knows what it's like to be a candidate and a lawmaker and someone just crazy enough to throw his name into the race. Jim Walsh, state representative from Aberdeen, joins me now. Welcome back to the show.
It's good to talk to you, Jason. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. You do have to be a little crazy to say, I'm going to take on the challenge of getting more Republicans elected in Washington. So why did you decide to step up for this position?
Well, Jason, the real reason is my district is a district that used to be considered impossible for a conservative. It was considered a deep blue district. They called it a blue wall. And living in it for, you know, most of my adult life, I knew that there was more to it than that, that the people of my district were not, you know, cogs. They were not automatons who voted automatically. They were people, and they wanted good things for themselves and their families and their kids. And what we worked on in my part of the state was really talking to people and listening to people and being better representatives for them and better lawmakers on their behalf and giving them an option that was real and better for their interests and their families' interests and their local community's interests. And we were able, in talking to people like that and giving them better representation, real, honest representation in the political system, and really simple values and no blarney, we were able to turn a part of the state that was considered deep blue into a part that's now considered deep red.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what we take from my part of the state are some lessons we can take to fixing what's broken in the state at large.
Does the fact that you're a lawmaker make this role, you think, a little bit easier to manage?
I think so. It shows me both the inside game in Olympia and to some degree in D.C., although I'm in Olympia, as well as the outside game of what regular normal people think about politics and about policy and about what works in government and what doesn't. So I do think it helps. It helps give a 360-degree view of how we can make the system work better for more people.
Would you hold both positions?
It's been done in the past. At least initially, I wouldn't change too much of what I'm doing. But, you know, if I do become state chair, in time, I think it would be tough to do both. But for the near term, there's historical precedent for it, and I wouldn't want to rock either boat too much. So for a little while, I would balance both, and then make a decision sometime down the road.
What do you think has been getting in the way, truly, of winning some elections? I think oftentimes just giving like a blanket, we need better candidates, is sometimes absolutely true. But I look at this last election and I look at Greg Gilday, a state representative, who lost to Clyde Shavers, a guy who lied about his military background. And that was not due to a lack of a quality candidate in Gilday. So what is the reason?
No, Gilday was an excellent candidate and an excellent lawmaker, and that was a real loss for the whole state. Some of it's mechanical, Jason. Some of it is we need to do a better job of building infrastructure, and campaign infrastructure. And that's boots on the ground game, whatever you want to call it. It's a more organized system, but it's a human system. It's people. It's finding people and activating people and giving local people in local communities something that they can believe in, something they can hang their hat and their hopes on and get excited about. And we have not done enough to build and nurture our local ground game, our local people, humans, who, 'cause in politics as in business, the best marketing, the best promotion is word of mouth. Mm-hmm. And that's where we need to build, and I think we will have the opportunity to do that as conservatives in the coming months and couple of years.
Does that include embracing ballot harvesting?
Oh, absolutely, it does. Let's be crystal clear: what is generally called ballot harvesting—that is, the collecting and maintenance and delivery of ballots to local election officials, usually your county auditor. It is completely legal in the state of Washington. And to pretend it's not, or to stand on some sort of misguided belief that it's illegal, that doesn't do us any good. We need to play the game. We need to engage by the rules in front of us, and we need to win under these rules. So ballot harvesting is something that is legal in this state. It is something that a smart, aggressive candidate or a party structure will do. And we will do that more effectively going forward.
State Representative Jim Walsh joining me on the line. He is running to replace Caleb Heimlich to become the next Washington State Republican Party chair. At the same time, there are a lot of Republicans who still don't trust the system, who I think many times, while they're well-intentioned, they end up believing things that are not backed by actual facts in elections being stolen. And while I certainly understand concern, and I think that election integrity as a general issue is incredibly important, and we should be doing auditing, and we should be making sure that there are people who are maintaining or at least providing oversight for our elections, it also is a self-defeating argument because it gets people not to vote. And I think that's a significant issue that Republicans still have to tackle. We are telling people that elections are stolen, why vote? And that is depressing the vote.
Correct. If you were trying to come up with a clever Machiavellian way to depress the vote, you would use election integrity and doubts about it as your tool for depressing the vote. So we have to combat that. We have to remind people that Washington is an all mail-in ballot state. We are one of the few that are like that, that are so like that. And we have to operate slightly differently on election integrity issues than other states. We aren't Arizona. You know, we aren't Wisconsin or Michigan. Here, we have to be laser focused on the condition and the currency of our voter rolls, the databases of registered voters. That's where we need to focus our election integrity efforts. We need to make sure that those voter rolls, the voter databases, the lists of registered voters to whom ballots are mailed each election cycle are current. That is, they do not have dead people on them. They do not have people who've moved out of state on them. They do not have people who, for whatever reason, are not legal to be registered voters on them. We need to keep those lists as clean as they can be. Now, the law calls for that, the state law, but we don't do enough to implement that portion of the state law that puts pressure on local elections administrators to keep those lists clean and updated. We need to do better by that law and keep those lists clean. That reduces the occasion for wrongdoing.
Yeah.
That reduces the possibility of manipulation or funny business with any of our elections.
There's a plan at the state level, the party level, to have a convention in which the folks with the party are voting to endorse one candidate in these statewide races. And in the case of governor, I think it's pretty clear as to why they want to do that, which is let's stop spreading the vote around. Do you endorse that idea?
100%. In fact, it was an idea that my wife, who was the state committee woman for our part of the state, our county, originally put together some years ago. It is absolutely it's a great idea for the parties. The top two primary system that we have in Washington is basically designed to disempower political parties, and it's been pretty effective at that. A way that the political parties can be useful to the people of the state is to be a clearinghouse, to be a mechanism for clearing out candidates who don't have a good chance of being elected, and rallying attention and resources around candidates who have the best chance of being elected. And that's a service that parties can provide to the voters of the state, sort of be the vetting system, be the clearinghouse, and to move the parties, conventions earlier in the election year, so that their nominating process is important to determining best candidates, I think is a service that political parties can do for the people. I mean, people like to rip on political parties, and I understand that. But
it's fun.
Being that clearinghouse, being right, even for people in the parties,
exactly.
It's fun sometimes. But I think that's a real good that parties could do to sort of clear the field and give voters, clear and well checked candidates, choices to make when they vote. And that's something good that parties can do for the people of the state.
So last question for you. Obviously, the folks who are listening right now can't endorse you or explicitly vote for you for this position. And we don't know who else is going to run. But if there's someone who wants to help you in your cause, what do they do?
Well, the best thing is, as I said before, it's just word of mouth. Talk to people you know. Talk about what we want to do to really make, in my case, the Republican Party, but all political parties in the state, more useful, more effective, to do good for people and not just be something that people rip on. I want the political parties, mine, the Republicans, as well as the others, to be good mechanisms for democracy, good mechanisms for encouraging people, not discouraging people, to get involved. And I think there's plenty of room to do that. And in the process, maybe change some minds about what it is to be a Republican in Washington State and what it is to support good, limited government and families and safe streets and things that most people want.
There you go. State Representative Jim Walsh. He wants to be the next chair of the Washington State Republican Party. We wish you the best of luck.
Thanks, Jason. It's going to be a great time.
Indeed it will be. I'm a political nerd. I know you are, too. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rants. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rants is in focus now.
Jason Rants, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
You can tell the Democrats are getting more and more antsy with Joe Biden, or at least picking up on other people being more antsy about whether or not they should. It's not so much as whether or not they're going to vote for Joe Biden. Democrats who are hardcore Democrats, they're not changing their vote no matter who the nominee is. The same way that hardcore Republicans would never change their vote for the most part, right? I mean, if you're a believer that Democrats are the best or Republicans are the best, by default, you will end up supporting whomever has a D or an R next to their name. That's how ideologues and activists vote. But there are a large number of people who don't consider either party the best thing in the world, the party that they have to offer their allegiance to. And I think that that's a healthy position to take, to not just marry yourself to a party regardless of who the candidate is. because, you know, there's going to be times in which people aren't very good for the country or for your community, and you're going to notice that right off the bat. And in this case, I think people are looking to Kamala Harris and saying she is not what's best for this country. And they hold that position based on the fact that they don't think Joe Biden has what it takes to stay alive for a second term. That's an unfortunate reality of getting older, right? I mean, we all are going to die. We're all going to die. And it's an uncomfortable subject. But when it comes to our leaders, especially when they're the age and health of what Joe Biden is, I think it is a valid and reasonable question and concern. And if you don't think that Joe Biden is going to last a second term, you then question whether or not the vice president can take the position. And with a 37% approval rating, clearly people don't think that about Kamala Harris, and she's given no reason for people to think that. There are more people thus are standing up and saying, I don't know if it should be Joe Biden again. Maybe he shouldn't be running. Stephen A. Smith, of all people, said that on ESPN earlier today. And I guess it shocked some people. I don't know why it shocked people. His position seems, again, pretty reasonable.
Somebody's got to say it, so I'm going to say it.
Say it. Say it.
We need a new president in 2024. I'm not calling for him to be removed from office. I'm not calling for the 25th Amendment to be invoked so Kamala Harris could take over the presidency and all of this other stuff. That's not what I'm saying.
I got you. I heard
you. I'm not trying to disrespect our president.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that he has to put all those caveats there. But again, I think most people can reasonably look at Joe Biden and not have confidence. And that plays a role in this election as to whether or not the base will be excited and create the grassroots efforts that will be necessary to beat whomever the Republican is. I do think it's going to be easier to beat Donald Trump than it would be to beat Ron DeSantis or Tim Scott or Nikki Haley. There's no doubt that Trump has baggage. People can pretend all they want, but they pretend to the disadvantage of that campaign. Because if he's the nominee, and I would happily support him as nominee, the same way I would happily support pretty much any Republican against a Joe Biden, at least of the people who are running and have a reasonable shot, I think it's also important to understand that people share Stephen Smith's view on the left, and they're looking to other potential candidates. Now, Marianne Williamson is not going to get any support. She's not going anywhere. But Robert Kennedy Jr. is doing quite well. The numbers that he's bringing in, according to the polls, somewhere anywhere between 20 and 25%. I mean, that is rather significant. And if you're going into the elections, the primaries, and you know, you've got Biden skipping Iowa and New Hampshire altogether, which has been a claim that's been put out there by Robert Kennedy Jr. But going out there and refusing to debate when you've got someone who's pulling in 20 to 25%, if not more at the time of the vote, that's not a good look. And it's going to suggest that Joe Biden is hiding something. And I think that's why people are starting to go after Robert F. Kennedy Jr. You've got the anti-vax attacks against him. And by the way, he is an anti-vaxxer. He is still pushing just patently false claims about the vaccine causing autism. He is, when it comes to this, he is a kook. I'm not going to pretend to be all that familiar with all of his other positions, but he's a Democrat, so I imagine most of the positions I'm going to disagree with. Though he did come out and he said he's going to be pretty tough at the border.
Over the next 3 days, be meeting with people from the Border Patrol and elsewhere to try to formulate policies that will seal the border permanently, and stressing the school systems, stressing the social service systems for people who are already, for Americans who are already struggling. It needs to be turned off.
Now, I think, again, that's going to appeal to Democrats along with the Republicans. He doesn't care about the Republicans at this point. He wants to get past the primary stage. But that is going to resonate with Democrats. I know that Democrats want to pretend that everyone seems to support on the left open borders. That's not true. The radical left does. That part's true, hence the title of my upcoming book. There is a radical group of folks who do not reflect the positions of the average Democrat. But because he's speaking in a way that is gaining the attention of folks on the left, you've got some of the establishment folks who are trying to undercut his message. J. Jessica Tarlov, for example, on The Five yesterday, made the argument about how, you know, he's obviously an unserious person, because why would he talk with Elon Musk and Tulsi Gabbard on Twitter Space, which is a bizarre sort of criticism. He's talking to the people, but let's listen.
Can I say something quickly about RFK?
No.
If you Junior, to be clear. If you are a serious Democratic candidate, you are not hanging out in a Twitter space with Elon Musk and Tulsi Gabbard.
Why?
Because that is not who we want to hear from. It's not who we respect, and it's not who aligns with our principles.
Wait a second. That's where everything's going. Elon Musk is making the world go electric. How's that not your principle?
What's that got to do with it?
The fact that all Republicans are defending him, and I know.
Come on.
You got what? So agitated.
No, talk about the issues.
Are you agitated?
I'll show you about the issues.
If you watch this show, there's a problem.
I watch the show. I live this show.
Yeah.
And I know there's no problem with me. And I'm telling you honestly about what's going on in the Democratic Party.
We will respectfully disagree that there's no problem.
There's no respect. I can feel it. Yeah, on either side right now, but I am correct.
But she's not correct. That's why RFK Jr. is getting 20-25% support right now. It's because she's not correct. And the fact that he's willing to talk to people in spaces that traditionally Democrats would ignore completely kind of makes the point that it's a party, much like the Republicans, that have to do a better job of reaching more people and not allowing a small group of radicals to define it. And that, for the most part, has been the Democrat Party over the course of the last, 6 years. I mean, since Trump. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to send me a text. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.